الطيبين الطاهرين، لا سيما بقيه الله في الارضين، عجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف. I'd like to first start by expressing my condolences to all of you brothers and sisters on coming on the month of Muharram, and as we continue to come closer towards the day of Ashura and the tragedy that occurred on that day. Inshallah, we'll begin with a few minutes in regard to the Ahkam and continuation of the Ahkam, and then inshallah we'll get to the main discussion for tonight. Last night and the previous night, we spoke about some uncertainties that may arise in one's prayer, and we classify them into three categories, a number of which will invalidate one's prayer, and a number of them which an individual should disregard and should not pay attention to and continue with the prayers. Of the 23, we have 9 remaining, which are uncertainties that might occur, which are correct, and an individual must continue with their prayers and not invalidate it. So, the first of those is if an individual, after the second sajda, that means they've completed both sajdas and now they have got up and are sitting down. They have an uncertainty whether they have completed 2 rak'ah or 3 rak'ah. They're uncertain between these two. The ruling here is that if the individual says that he's done 3, continues with the prayer with another rak'ah, finishes. Afterwards, there is a prayer that needs to be made up. He needs to perform 1 rak'ah of Salatul Ihtiyat. Afterwards, when the prayer is done. That's the first stage. So, sitting after the second sajda between 2 and 3. The next state is if an individual has an uncertainty between 2 and 4 in the same state. That means the second sajda is completed, he's now sitting. He's not sure whether he's done 2 rak'ah or 4 rak'ah. In this case, an individual must say that they've done 4, complete the prayer, then afterwards perform the ihtiyat prayer, which is 2 rak'ah standing. Notice, however many an individual has doubt for, then the ihtiyat needs to be completed. So that's 2. The third state is if an individual in the same state, that means after the second sajda, has a state of uncertainty between the second rak'ah, third or fourth. He doesn't know whether he's done 2, 3, or 4. Again, the same thing applies here. He says he's done 4, finishes the prayer, but in this case, he performs 2 rak'ah of Salatul Ihtiyat, both standing and both sitting. That means 4 rak'ah, 2 standing and 2 sitting down. The next case is if an individual has an uncertainty in the same stage between 4 and 5. He's not sure whether he's done 4 rak'ah or 5 rak'ah. In this case, the individual says he's done 4, finishes the prayer, then he says tashahud and salam. Afterwards, he only needs to do 2 sajdas of sahw, of forgetting to have done something or to have done something accidentally. And inshallah, we'll explain what these are. So those were 4 so far. The fifth case is if an individual is uncertain whether he's done 3 rak'ah or 4 rak'ah, any part in the prayer. That means any stage of the prayer, he is uncertain of this, whether he's done 3 or 4. They must conclude that they've done 4, continue with the prayer wherever they may be. So if they're standing, they continue with the prayer until they've gone to tashahud and salam. So they finish the prayer. Afterwards, they need to do 1 rak'ah of Salatul Ihtiyat standing, or they have the option to do 2 rak'ah sitting down. So they have the choice of either. That's the fifth case. The sixth case comes if an individual is uncertain whether they've done 4 rak'ah or 5 rak'ah while they are standing up. That means during Qiyam. Whether it be they're doing the Surah Al-Fatiha or the other surah. They don't know whether they've done 4 rak'ah or 5. Again, they must conclude that they've done 4. They finish the prayer. I'm sorry, they must conclude that they've done 4 because they're standing. They sit down. They sit down, they do the tashahud and the salam, finish the prayer. Afterwards, they have again the option of either doing 1 rak'ah of Salatul Ihtiyat standing or 2 rak'ah sitting down. So this was the sixth one. When you're standing up between 4 and 5, you sit down, finish the prayer, and now the Salatul Ihtiyat. The seventh case is if an individual has uncertainty between 3 rak'ah and 5 rak'ah when he's standing again during Qiyam. The same thing applies. He now, this changes and diverts into an individual having a uncertainty between 2 and 4. So pretty much the person comes to the understanding that he's done 4, he sits down, and then he must do the Salatul Ihtiyat as well, which is 2 rak'ah standing up. I know these are hard to keep track of, but some of them are really less common. For someone to be standing and not sure whether he's done 3 or 5 rak'ah is really not very common unless you're not paying much attention in your prayer. So that's number 7. Number 8 is between 3, 4, and 5. The person is uncertain while he's standing up. This is now, it's getting towards something that's very rare. But in this case, an individual, again, he sits down as if he's done 4, does a tashahud, does a salam, and now he must also perform 2 raka'ah of salatul ihtiyat, both standing and also 2 sitting down. So a total of 4. And the last case is if an individual is unsure between performing 5 and 6 raka'ah, which is extremely rare. Usually we don't pray more than we need to, therefore we don't come to a state of doing 5 raka'ah or 6 raka'ah. But in the case that it does exist, for example, then the individual, again, they need to conclude that they've done 4, they sit down, complete the prayer, and then they only perform 2 sajda of sahw. They don't perform any salatul ihtiyat. So these were the 9 cases that an individual comes to an uncertainty in their prayer, that the uncertainty is valid. They don't invalidate the prayer, they don't abandon the prayer. Rather, they continue with their prayer based on the rulings here, and they perform any salatul ihtiyat or any sajda sahw that needs to be done afterwards. Since we're short on time, inshallah, tomorrow night, we'll discuss what salatul ihtiyat is, how one must perform it, and also the sajda sahw. What it is and how must one perform it if one of these uncertainties come up, or in any other cases that one is required to perform such a sahw after the prayer is completed, inshallah. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So in the previous nights, we have stated a number of social elements and social ills that existed in the Islamic world and in society as a whole, and how the enemies of Islam, how the munafiqeen, and how the individuals who were looking to benefit from the religion were able to then use and manipulate these for their own benefit. Last night we spoke about one of the major theological distortions which existed after the death of the Holy Prophet, and that was the disallowance of the narration of the hadith of the Holy Prophet. And we spoke about what effects it had on society then, and what effects it continues to have in today's world, in today's Islamic world. Of the social elements that we spoke about, if you remember, one of them, and the final one of the 3, was a lack of iman and lack of Islamic belief. That means true belief in the teachings of Islam. When we discussed this, time was short, so we only really made reference to the concept in general. Tonight, inshallah, we'd like to open this up. What is meant by the lack of iman and faith, and in what areas did individuals lack faith and belief in Islam? So we know that the individuals looking to benefit from Islamic society were munafiqs, and we had already defined who munafiqs are. So a munafiq that has another goal other than the image that he portrays of himself exteriorly, he will obviously never have true belief and true understanding in the teachings of Islam. Whether it be the oneness of Allah, whether it be the prophethood of the Holy Prophet, whether he is the final prophet, or whether individuals who should success him and individuals who would gain stature through the religion, whether they should be respected and they should be followed. In any of these levels, hypocrites obviously will not have a level of belief in iman. But the people around them and the people that they manipulated were not all munafiqeen. Some of them were really trying to be genuine and true Muslims. But what they did was they were able to manipulate, they were able to benefit from this social ill to help shape the beliefs of individuals towards those in which they had in mind. And they did this by weakening the iman and the strength and the belief that these Muslims or so-called Muslims had towards Islamic teachings. Now, there's one thing that we know in Islam, is that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us in a number of stages in the Holy Quran the qualities that exist in man, whether good ones or bad ones. Man has been created a certain way, and certain qualities exist in him. One of those qualities, which if abused and not used properly and not brought up properly, it will lead to the social ill of the love and attachment towards this world. So the love and attachment of this world is a result of a natural and innate quality that exists in the creation of man, and inshallah we'll explain how one goes from this, you can say, the safe nature and the natural nature in which man has been created towards this stage. Now, the first thing that we need to look at here is that man has been created for what? What is the philosophy and reasoning behind the creation of man? We know that we have all been created out of the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That is understood. Because as creations and as existence, that our existence is dependent on another, we know that we didn't bring ourselves into existence. If someone wants to look at it as a logical and philosophical view, we know that as beings, we did not bring ourselves into existence. Therefore, we are dependent on another being. Now, what has Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created us for? This is a very common question asked by all human beings. So long as they're really understand their existence, and so long as they're not so busy and occupied with thoughts and activities that keep them away from their true nature, at some point in an individual's life, they will ask this question, why have I been created and what is my purpose in this life? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala explains His purpose of man in a verse of the Holy Qur'an, which makes it extremely simple and brief. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala states in the Holy Qur'an, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, وَمَا خَلَقْتَ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنسِ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ, that I have not created man and the jinn other than for him to worship me. Now to worship him, you know, we know ibadah is in a number of forms. We have traditional ibadah like the salah and the dua and things of that nature. We have other non-traditional forms of ibadah. In the sense that anything that is done to please Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is considered to be ibadah. So, we know that our purpose behind existence is to worship and please Him. Now, for us to have been put in this world also has a philosophy and reasoning behind it and its purpose. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, through the teachings and through the hadith of the Holy Prophet, tells us that what is the role of this universe, what is the role of this world? We know there's a very famous hadith from the Holy Prophet that he says that this world is like a plane and like a ground, that man must use it towards reaching and preparing himself for the hereafter. The dunya, inna ad-dunya mazra'atul akhirah, that the life and the world here is only a means for one to prepare himself for another life and the hereafter. Which we know this life is limited and finite, and the hereafter is continuous and absolute. So we know that we need to prepare ourselves, and this dunya is the means of it. And we also have numerous ahadith which make reference to the fact that the dunya is really a prison for the believers. And for the disbelievers, it is a heaven. So we already know what heaven is and what heaven isn't. So this world is not heaven. You can be assured of that. The simplest reason is given the fact that it's finite. It will end, so it obviously it's not something worth investing too much in. So, what is being said here is that an individual should not have love and should not have attachment towards a tool and resource. If we look at it from a very logical perspective, one individual doesn't love the resources and tools that he uses. He loves the goal and result in which he wishes to achieve. If you're using a hammer to nail something in the wall, and your goal is to build a structure, your love and your drive is the structure, not the hammer itself. So this dunya is a tool. And in the nature of man, which we said can lead to this, is a sense of anxiety and anxiousness. In what sense? In the sense that man has been created in a fashion that he likes to progress. And he likes to be constantly in a state of motion. Now this can be in two stages. I'd like to reference a verse from the Holy Quran in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us and explains this anxiety and the split. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala states in Surah Al-Qiyamah, it says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, إِنَّ الْإِنسَانَ خُلِقَ هَلُوعًا. Verily that man has been created anxiously, anxious, in a state of anxious. إِذَا مَسَّهُ الشَّرُّ جَزُوعًا. And when a state of evil or something bad comes into his life, what does he happen? He's impatient. وَإِذَا مَسَّهُ الْخَيْرُ مَنُوعًا. And when goodness comes into his life, what does he do? He withholds it. So when something bad is happening, he's anxious towards succeeding. Therefore, he is now impatient. And when something good comes to him, he withholds it. Now this is going to have a number of interpretations. Our interpretation that we're trying to get right now is the fact that man likes what is good. And he likes to progress towards what is good and what is better. He is constantly in the struggle of success. But there is a problem here in this. That if this isn't attached and it isn't supplemented with other qualities, this will lead to man reaching something that is not meant by the existence of this quality. If you do not pair this anxiousness with patience, then you'll have a problem. Why? Because you always like things to happen immediately. And again, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala makes reference to this in the same surah, Surah Al-Qiyamah, in which He says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, كَلَّا بَلْ تُحِبُّونَ الْعَاجِلَةِ. No, but you desire and like the immediate. وَتَذَرُونَ الْآخِرَةِ. And you forget and you release the hereafter. Why? Because that requires you to be patient and wait. So this is a quality in nature that exists in all human beings. And if it's not tamed properly, if Islamic teachings and morals are not instilled in one soul, if the nafs isn't tamed with things like patience, things like God consciousness and taqwa, then that will lead them towards becoming a greedy individual. Al-Haris. Imam Ali alayhi salam, salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Imam Ali alayhi salam has been narrated to have said that Al-Harisu Faqir, a greedy individual is a poor one. Well, this doesn't make sense. Normally a greedy individual is someone who likes to gather everything and then he becomes rich. And Faqir, for to be poor, is the exact opposite. So this is kind of contradictory. But what does he mean? It says, وَلَوْ مَلَكَ الدُّنْيَا بِحَذَرَافِهَا. He means that a greedy individual is poor even if he has everything in the world. Why? Because in reality his greed has led him towards claiming things that are insignificant. Things that will not last. And we know there's a hadith and a very famous saying from the Holy Prophet that he says that the root of all mistakes originates from what? From the love of this world. حُبُّ الدُّنْيَا رَأْسُ كُلِّ خَطِيرًا. So there is a clear warning from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in these teachings of Islam that, O mankind, be aware that if you do not take care of yourself, you may also turn into such an individual, Al-Haris. The Holy Imam says, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, رُبَّ حَرِيسٍ قَتَلَهُ حِرْسُ. Look at how beautiful this riwayah is. He says, often do you find a greedy person that his greed kills him. Now this is a concept that really examples are numerous in today's world. How many greedy people do we know that their greed has ended up killing them? So we'd like to start this concept of greed from the time of the Holy Prophet. We know the introduction of Islam was again one that would instill the values of social equality and justice for all. So social justice and greed cannot be combined. Equality and greed cannot be combined. They're opposites. You cannot be a fair and just person and also be greedy. Because if you're greedy, you'd like to take all for yourself and leave nothing for the rest. So, did this notion of greediness exist in the early stages of Islam? Yes. Where? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us in the Holy Quran. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. أَلَمْ تَرَ إِلَى الَّذِينَ قِيلَ لَهُمْ كُفُّوا أَيْدِيَكُمْ وَأَقِيمُوا الصَّلَاةَ وَآتُوا الزَّكَاةَ فَلَمَّا كُتِبَ عَلَيْهِمُ الْقِطَالِ إِذَا فَرِيقٌ مِّنْهُمْ يَخْشَوْنَ النَّاسِ كَخَشْيَةِ اللَّهِ أَوْ أَشَدَّ خَشْيَةِ وَقَالُوا رَبَّنَا لِمَ كَتَبْتَ عَلَيْنَا الْقِطَالِ لَوْلَا أَخَّرْتَنَا إِلَى أَجَلٍ قَرِيبٍ قُلْ مَتَاعُ الدُّنْيَا قَلِيلٌ وَالْآخِرَةُ خَيْرٌ لِمَنِ اتَّقَى وَلَا تُظْلَمُونَ فَتِيلًا. This verse came in reference to a number of events that took place. In the early days of Islam, we know that Islam was being spread silently, and the majority of the followers of the message of the Holy Prophet were who? Those who were poor and the younger ones. Why? Because really these two groups of people were those that the most injustices were being committed against them. So obviously there would be the forefront individuals towards a society which is just and equal. Because equality didn't exist in that society. During the early stages, there were a number of individuals that would constantly come to the Holy Prophet and ask him, Ya Rasulullah, allow us to engage in battle with these enemies that are degrading our status, given the fact we are Muslim, given the fact that we are trying to establish the notion of equality, and we are of a lower stature in society as deemed today, that means in that time of the Islamic world, the Muslim world, the Arab world, allow us to go and fight with them and prove to them who we are and show them our power. The Holy Prophet said, no, right now is not the time for this. Right now is the time for you to be occupied with prayers and for you to be occupied with giving charity and building yourself. Building yourself at a moral level. For your character will be necessary later. So what happened? Time passed, and after Islam began to grow, there came a time where the Holy Prophet, by the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, asked these same individuals to engage in battle now. It was now time to engage in battle and stand up against the kuffar. These same individuals then turned around and said, Ya Rasulullah, right now we don't really want to engage in battle. And they were so afraid of battle that their level of fear was as if, or equivalent to the level of fear that they had towards Allah. This is the translation of the verse. Have you not seen those who were told to stop fighting and to establish prayers and pay religious debts? That means the early days when they kept asking. When they were ordered to fight, later on, some of them feared other men as much as, or more than they feared Allah. So they said, Lord, why have you ordered us to fight? If only you would give us a little more time. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, tell them the pleasures of the worldly life are trivial. The life hereafter is best for the pious ones. You will not be treated the slightest bit unjustly. So what happened between this period of time? One day, they're ready to engage in war, and the next, they fear war, they fear the opposition, they don't want to engage. What happened in between? What happened was, they didn't engage in prayers and paying religious taxes, and as a result, they weren't able to prepare their characters towards then performing the will of Allah later. Because whenever Allah wills something, as a servant of Him, you must be prepared to go forth and perform that action, whatever it may be. So these individuals lack that nafs and the character that will allow them to do that. They became greedy towards the world. If I fight now, I will lose everything that I've worked to accomplish. I have a family now, I have money now, I have a house now, I have loved ones. If I go and fight, there's a possibility that I'll be killed, and I'll have to lose all of these things. So please, Allah, don't order us to fight right now, give us a little more time. Let us enjoy our lives. So this is an attachment that exists in everybody, and this is a very clear example of what happened to the early Muslims that were so full of energy towards supporting Islam, and what happened to them only a few short years later. And these events existed and continued to show themselves later. We all know that during the Battle of Badr, that the Muslimin, it was the first time that the Muslimin had come to battle with the Kuffar in this stage, in this status, this grand level of battle. The Muslims were victorious. And in battle, it is clear that when one side becomes victorious, there are certain treasures and booty left from the spoils of war. The spoils of war are left from the other side that is now either the fallen soldiers have left behind, or when the soldiers of the opposing army abandon it, they leave certain things with them. So these are the spoils of war that are entitled to the army that has been successful. After the battle, the army of Islam divided into three groups. There were one group that stayed and guarded the Holy Prophet. God forbid anything was to happen. One group followed the army that had abandoned the war to make sure they wouldn't regroup and re-attack. And the third group was responsible towards gathering the spoils of war and bringing it back. So each one completed their responsibility, and then they all gathered. An individual then rose and asked the Holy Prophet, when they were dividing the spoils of war, look at this greed. He said that, Ya Rasulullah, will you divide and will you equate us and me, meaning the individuals who were active in battle and eliminated more enemies, the same as the old and the weak that stayed in the back and didn't really participate as much as us. So since I killed more people, I should get more money. The Holy Prophet said no. He said, was it not for these same old and weak people, would we not achieve victory? So don't get too ahead of yourself. Don't think it is really you and your power and your muscle that has done anything to influence this victory here. The spoils will be divided equally. One example. Again, the next battle, the battle of Uhud. We know that in the battle of Uhud, the Muslimin had gained an early victory. Before the battle took place, the Holy Prophet had assigned a number of archers in a specific position up in the mountains to both oversee and guard an area that the army of the opposition could ambush them. And given the fact that the Holy Prophet had experience in battle, and he had individuals there helping him, so they knew the tactics of war. They weren't amateurs in that sense. So he knew that this area needs to be secured, and this insurance needs to exist. So he commanded those archers that under no circumstances should you leave your post. And he even added this point, which is even more interesting, that even if we are victorious, and the spoils of war are left, do not leave your post to go collect the spoils. See, when the war is done and the spoils are left, one wouldn't think that the army would return to attack them. The war is done, now it is time for us to relax and go gather the spoils that are left and then, for example, regroup and return. So what happened? The Muslimin were victorious in the early stages. The enemies began to retreat. So a number of the soldiers that were on the field began to collect the spoils of war. These archers that were there, this sense of greed, began to now show itself. Said, they're getting the spoils of war, maybe it won't be spread equally. I also need to make sure I go down and get my own share. Sometimes we see this at very, you know, smaller stages when in our lives, when you see that something is available, and you say, I also have a right to have as much as the other person, so you make sure you get there, and you also take the same amount as the other person has. So this greed. It's my right, so let me go and collect it. So they disobeyed the command of the Holy Prophet, and they disobeyed the command of their leader that was also present with them. In which he ordered them, did the Prophet not tell you not to leave your post? Why are you leaving? They said, the war is over, the spoils are here, let us go and collect. So they left. What happened? The general of the enemy saw that. He saw that this post had been abandoned and there are only a few soldiers left. Very easily and simply they came, they eliminated and they martyred the few soldiers that were left. And they ambushed the army of the Holy Prophet and all of them were all busy collecting the spoils of war. They attacked them and the Islamic army suffered defeat. Why? Was it because they were a weaker army? No, because their greed got the better of them. And instead of being alert and following orders, they let their greed and their worldly desire get the better of them. So these are two examples of this worldly attachment and greed that existed during the time of the Holy Prophet, which had very monumental effects. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
So, when this happened, a verse from the Holy Quran was then revealed. We know in Surah Al-Anfal, and we've all, inshallah, read this. The first verse of Surah Al-Anfal is in reference to this exactly. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, yas'alunaka 'anil anfal. They ask you of the anfal. Anfal is the spoils of war. They ask you of this anfal. قُلِ الْأَنْفَالُ لِلَّهِ وَالرَّسُولِ. Say that these spoils of wars are Allah's property and His Prophet's property. فَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ وَأَصْلِحُوا ذَاتَ بَيْنِكُمْ وَأَطِيعُوا اللَّهَ وَرَسُولَهُ إِن كُنتُم مُؤْمِنِينَ. The decisions concerning the bounties is for Allah and His Messenger. So fear Allah and amend which is between you and obey Allah and His Messenger if you should be believers. That means the spoils of war does not concern you. Let Allah and His Messenger deal with that portion. They know best as to who should get what and how much of it. Which means there's another message embedded in this verse. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, do not overstep your boundaries. Certain responsibilities are that of Allah and His Messenger, and certain responsibilities are that of creations and followers. So it's important not for you to overstep your boundaries, thinking that sometimes you're doing a good thing, when in fact you're doing something that destroys and hurts and damages other people. So, these verses were revealed. This continued, this culture of greediness and worldly attachment continued into the after the death of the Holy Prophet, during the time of the Khulafa. Now we know that during the time of the Khulafa, Islam was growing very rapidly. The futuhat were taking place and they would then conquer new lands, and Islam was being introduced, and with the introduction of Islam, Islam grew. So with that fact, also the finances of Islam and the support base of Islam also grew. In this time period of the futuhat and the growth of Islam, a number of individuals got very rich very fast. Extremely rich, extremely fast. How? During the time of the second Khalifa, there was an extreme amount of misuse towards the Baytul Mal. Baytul Mal is the money that is for the people, and only the Khalifa, a just Khalifa, has the right and will actually know how to distribute it. So when all this money is now coming in, all of these spoils of war, all of this money is now flowing into the Islamic world, and you have someone in charge, or individuals in charge, who haven't conquered this desire, and this greed exists. So they began to abuse this Baytul Mal. They put people in charge that their only goal was to be able to take as much as they can. During the time of the second Khalifa. The third Khalifa, it got even worse. In what sense? He then declared that the Baytul Mal wasn't the money of the people, rather it was his. So that means as the Khalifa, all the Baytul Mal becomes his money, and then he distributes it any way he likes. Which means what? That means he doesn't have any responsibility towards giving anyone anything. And if he does, it's out of the goodness of his heart. Look at how, you know, again, the distortion of the definitions of Islamic law. So what did this man do? He hired his relatives. He hired the people close to him. And he made his friends, the governors and the leaders and rulers of other cities and other areas of the Islamic world. And we give examples of how, for example, Muawiyah did that as well in previous nights. And it's interesting, when they would distribute the Baytul Mal, everyone should be equal. If a certain amount of money is being given to the Muslimin as a whole, everyone should get the same amount. Why? Because no one person is better than the other. If everyone is really a true Muslim, and everyone is performing their responsibilities in regards to being a Muslim, then no individual should get more than the other. They record and narrate that during a year's time, certain people would be given 300 dirham a year, while others would be given up to 12,000 dirham a year. So what happens here? When someone is given 300 and someone 12,000, now we are creating different classes in society. Different economical classes. And what is a result of that? Class warfare. This word class warfare, does it ring a bell in today's society, especially here? We are experiencing class warfare, right? Class warfare doesn't come into existence by accident. It comes into existence by the inequality and by the injustices done in regards to the resources and how they should be distributed. So these individuals created a higher class which never existed in Islam prior to that, and was in direct contradiction to the teachings and the foundation of Islam. As we've said this numerous times, the goal of the Holy Prophet and the introduction of Islam was to do what? Create equality. That means create a middle class. That means almost everyone should be at the same level. Yes, there may be some that Allah has blessed more. That is always something natural. We said in the verse before the speech, that is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala who gives and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala who takes. Wallahu yaqbidu wa yabsut. If He wants, He gives, and if He wants, He takes away. So some might have been given more, and some might have been given less. But does that make them a higher class and a lower class? No. They're simply responsible more. The one who's been given more is responsible towards making sure that who has been given less or has less opportunities, he helps balance that. Again, what is one of the big discussions that exists in American society, we're trying to make links, but we don't really want to get really too into the politics of the country. But what are the big discussions when they speak about this notion of class warfare and whether the high class should be taxed more? This is one of the discussions going on today. The higher class says, what reason exists for us to be taxed more? We are the higher class because we are successful. We have worked more. We have put more time and energy. And if we have been successful in our life, it's our right to be able to enjoy the luxuries that exist. But what problem exists in this statement? What does Islam say about this statement? It says that yes, you may have become successful out of your own energy, out of your own hard work. No one will refute that, given the fact that that does exist. We're not even entering this element and this stage of corruption. We're leaving that aside. We are assuming the fact that everyone who has become successful and everyone who is rich has done so by moral means and ethical means. Okay, we're assuming this. As a human being, as a nationalist, do you not also have the responsibility to understand and acknowledge the fact that yes, maybe you have been grown, maybe you have grown up, maybe you have been put in an environment that all of these blessings have been readily available for you? Do you think that it is only you that can succeed and become a CEO or a CFO or a top surgeon or top doctor if they are put in the circumstances of what? Growing up in a very financially stable family, a very wealthy family, a very good and supportive environment, and everyone there to be able to push you towards doing the right thing. Go to the top universities, get scholarships, have connections to be able to do this and that for you. It isn't anything special for you to now become a doctor, to become a CFO, to become a CEO of a company, given that fact. I challenge that every individual, if they're put in the same situation, they can achieve the same things. What is being left out and ignored is that your success is dependent on the environment and the blessings that you've had. Some are less fortunate than you. Do you think someone who lives in a society and an environment that is filled with drugs and is filled with anything that you can think that is immoral, they don't know who their parents are, they think the whole world hates them, and other social diseases are purposefully being put in their communities, they have to break their backs to even make it to college or university, and even if they do, some look down upon them as betraying their culture. Do you think a person who fails in that environment is because he is not hardworking or because he is dumb or stupid? No. It's because as a society we have ignored them, we have turned our backs on them, we have not created social equality, we have been greedy, and therefore we have deemed ourselves to be the successful ones and those to be individuals who are lazy and individuals who do not work hard. And those who have really abandoned success in their lives. They are unsuccessful. This is a problem that exists all over the world. And this is a problem that was addressed 1400 years ago by Islam and was addressed by previous religions. Every messenger that God sent on this earth, the message was to instill this statement that every man is equal. Don't look at yourself as a better human being just because you have a different style of life or a different position in life. We have so many hadith from the Holy Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, for us to be followers of them, we should replicate their actions, and our ideology should be their ideologies. When they say that, when you look at a man, don't think that you are better than him. For it may be possible that that man internally is better than you. Sometimes we see people, and unfortunately, due to a lack of proper upbringing and Islamic morals, we tend to judge. We see someone and we say, oh, this person is not a good Muslim, for example, he's not a good human being. For sure I'm better than him. Why? Because I pray, and I come to the masjid, and I come to the majlis, and I cry for Imam Hussein, so surely I'm better than this person. Islam tells us that no, don't ever let this idea cross your mind. How do you know what stature and what stage that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sees him? So this is a problem that exists in today's society. As Muslims, as individuals who are aware of this, we are responsible towards spreading this message of equality and justice around the world. And so long as we don't know that the first people who will be held accountable are not John and Joe and Bob and so on and so forth, it'll be us, it'll be the Muhammads and the Alis and so on and so forth. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So, a question that we can ask is how can we go about fighting this greed? How can we go about changing this personality and this quality of greed? We are short on time, so we'll make reference to a few small things and inshallah then we'll continue. Again, we need to spend hours and hours and sessions on these things. Because these are the things that are really shaping today's world. And to falsely think that no, we understand what equality is, we understand what greed is and what greed isn't, and we are not greedy, is really doing a disservice, and for you to ignore this is wrong. To be extremely brief and blunt, it's wrong. We know that every day we can strive towards being better people, and we should always have that mentality in mind. To say that we have conquered something, a quality or a way of life, and then put that aside, is a wrong mentality. Because we know that at any time an individual can be influenced and can be tempted by his desires and the shaitan. So what are a few simple ways that one can combat this? The first is for us to remember death, and remember that death is the haq and the truth. If anyone wants a testament to the truth of death, we can take a trip to the graveyard. That those who have been buried in the graveyard have not risen since, and I'm sure there's nothing in the ground that they're doing and living a different life. The bodies are destroyed, disintegrated, and nothing's left in bones. So a greedy person, their greed is fueled by this notion that they think they're going to live forever. And until one doesn't acknowledge the truthfulness behind death, one will continue in his greediness and his continual strive towards gathering temporary wealth and thinking that he has now achieved something. We all know that when they take us to the grave, there's nothing that's going to come with us. Just a simple piece of cloth to cover the body. Can't take your house with you, can't take your cars with you, can't take your money with you. Nothing can come with you in the grave. So it's important that we remember death. And again, this is something that Islam, you know, advises us to do on a regular basis. Regularly remember death. Don't wait until somebody dies to remember death. This is typically the culture that exists in Islamic communities. We always wait until someone dies until we remember death is truly existent. We're all going to die, and then you see that around that time, people really get shocked and really check themselves as to what they're doing in life and where they are. And then because of the nature that man forgets, after a period of time, again, he goes back towards the same lifestyle. So the first is to remember death. One can remember death by remembering the ones who have passed. One can remember death by visiting the cemetery. Visiting the cemetery isn't a bad thing. It's good from time to time for people to go. This is actually one of the advices that our scholars give us, that every week, if it's possible, an individual should spend some time in the graveyard. To just go see that people have lived and people have died. And you were a person and are a person just like them, and one day the time will come for you to die. And when that day is not known by anybody other than Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So that's the first thing. The second thing is for all of us to sit, spend time and socialize with those that are less fortunate than us. Why is this so important? Because a greedy man and a greedy woman, their greed is fueled by the fact that they always compare themselves to individuals who are more fortunate than them and are doing better than them. They always compare themselves to someone who is better. So they say, I have, for example, a car, he has two cars. So I want to be better than him, so I should also have two cars. I should have three cars. So this greed continues to grow. He has a house this big. I need to have a house that big. So I don't look like I have anything less than him. But no one ever looks at those who are less fortunate than us. Do you ever go and spend time with the homeless man that has nowhere to sleep? You ever spend time with the individual who doesn't have power, doesn't have money to feed his children? This is something we have abandoned and forgotten in the teachings of Islam. That spending time with these individuals will make you self-conscious as to how fortunate you are, A, and what responsibilities you have towards those people. To seclude our socializing events with only people like us is something wrong. We should also include this element as well. And after that's done, to also donate and give charity in that means. The last one is for us to take lesson from our role models. We come here and we pay so much respect towards Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his followers and Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam and the Holy Prophet. Why? Because they are good human beings. They are perfect human beings. They are role models and examples for all of us. Would any of us really have this much respect for a man who is unclear whether he was a just person or not, whether he was an equal person or not, whether he had a good akhlaq or not? Of course not. I'm talking personally, I wouldn't. If I knew so-and-so was a bad man and committed injustice, there would be no way that I would come and spend time and try to propagate his message and live a life like him and then also sit and cry for him. Impossible. So what do our role models teach us in this regard? We have all heard and read the history of the Ahlul Bayt, and especially that of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. It is recorded, Salawat ala Muhammad wa Muhammad. It is recorded that Imam al-Hassan, in two points in his life, two separate points in his life, when a needy person or a group of needy people came to him, he divided his wealth and his belongings in half, and he gave half of it to the needy, and he kept half for himself. Half of his wealth. Think about that. If some needy Muslim comes to you and says, brother, I'm your brother in Islam, I am needy, really, I need help. How many of us are willing to split our wealth in half and give it to him? I have four cars, take two. I have a house that is 5 acres wide and long, okay, I'll sell my house, get a house on 2 acres, and you can have a house 2 acres. This doesn't exist in today's world. But at the same time, we also say that we are the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, and they are our role models. No contradiction here. Again, if we look at the lives of even more recent people, the true followers of the Ahlul Bayt, if we look at the lives of some of our scholars and some of the prestigious mu'mineen in the world, you can see this notion of giving and the elimination of this quality of greed. I'll share two very short stories with you. The first is that of Sheikh Abbas al-Qumi. We all know him where? He is a writer and the compiler of Mafatih al-Jannah. So we've all benefited from his works at some point. Whether it is continuously and consistently, which inshallah we should, or whether it's once or twice we just opened it and read it. So let's take a lesson from the life of this man. When he lived in Najaf, you know, a lot of the scholars, during their life, they really struggle financially. They live very extremely simple lives. And with the lowest amount of money, they can both manage their lives and they're happy. Now we're not talking about so-called scholars, these new age scholars, people like me. I'm not a scholar, but someone who tries to replicate them. Don't look at people like me, who not only demand the most in life, but show nothing in return for it. We were looking at true scholars, like Sheikh Abbas. When he was in Najaf, two women from Bombay had come to him, and people at that time knew the status of the scholars then and knew really what hardships they had. They were a little more, maybe well off. They wanted to give him 75 rupees for him to spend for himself, not for them to give it to him, for them to spend in Islamic ways. Said for yourself, for you to be able to live a little more, a life that you'll be able to, you know, feed and be able to purchase anything that is necessary in your personal life. Sheikh Abbas said no, he declined. He thanked them and he declined. They left. When he saw his son there, he said, the reason I didn't accept this is because the money that I've been given so far, I still don't have an answer as to what I'm going to tell Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on the day of judgment when He rises me and ask me, in what fashion have you used this money that I've given you? Think about someone who's living off peanuts. He is now concerned in how he's going to return and how he's going to answer the question of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as to how you spent your wealth. We know that during the day of judgment, there are numerous ahadith which mention this, that a number of questions will be asked on the day of judgment. One of the very important ones is, first of all, where you gained your wealth from, how you attained your wealth, and second, how you spent it. So this man is so God-fearing, so God-conscious, he is afraid that how is he going to answer the question of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on the day of judgment. So he says, no, I will not accept. Another example is that of Shaykh Abdul Karim Al-Ha'ari. Again, during his period of, while he was a grand scholar, these are grand scholars that really are in the face of all the people, they know them. A woman came to his house in the middle of the night. Think about 3-4 in the morning. Middle of the night, a woman knocked on his door, and his helper, one of his students, Sheikh Ali, he answered the door. The woman said, listen, oh man, I know this is the house of Sheikh Abdul Karim Al-Ha'ari. My husband is sick, he's not feeling well, we don't have any money for food, we don't have any money to buy firewood and heat the house, we have nothing. Can you please help us? The student said, listen, it's in the middle of the night, I can't help you right now. Come back later, inshallah we can work something out. Shaykh in the other room heard this. He went to his student and said, what are you going to answer in the face of Allah when He asks you, why did you decline help to this woman, this poor woman, at this time of the night? He asked him, do you know where this woman lives? The student said, yes. He said, let's go. This was in winter. It was cold, and apparently there was snow. This is how they narrated. So he said, in this